capitalist technology builds structural capacity that impacts low-income communities. He looks at that specifically in the context of Egypt. Samer has been a longtime political organizer. He's a Palestinian from Jerusalem, and he regularly publishes opinion articles about struggles on the ground in Palestine. I wanted to ask him about the long arc of grassroots Palestinian organizing for an end to the Israeli occupation in the West Bank, and then also throughout Palestine. And it was really, I think, an important conversation to sort of locate this moment in Palestinian history within an arc of struggle. So it was really great to speak with Samer for this week's edition of Free City Radio. Here's our conversation.
First of all, thank you for having me on your program. I have been an activist since I was a teenage. This was during the First Intifada, and part of the activities of the First Intifada that started in 1987. It was civil disobedience and boycott actions. So this was the basic framework of our activities, but most of these activities were organized within the Palestinian society between the river and the sea. So the people and the Israeli side occupied in 1948 were engaged in certain activities that suit their living conditions. People in Jerusalem also do similar things in Gaza and the West Bank. So this is how we started the movement. And later on, and actually I spent several years in the Israeli prisons because of these activities. We continued actually, and we got a new push after the Second Intifada. And in the Second Intifada, people think that was like based on certain military actions. It's totally opposite to us. Most of these actions were civil-based actions because most of the people were engaged in these activities. And we returned again to the issue of discussing, especially in since 2002, the issue of reintroducing the idea of boycott. And this started the discussion, and actually this discussion started with some colleagues who used to work for the advocacy desk at the YMCA. I later on joined them to work with them. And during that time, just to give you a brief history, then a letter came from the Higher Education Union in England to start the what they call it, the Bagbee's boycott activities at the higher education. And Bagbee started like boycott at the higher education level. And this was in late 2003, beginning of 2004. And there were a friend of mine who passed away called Adnan Atiyah who were discussing this. And Adnan asked me, hey, you were very active in this regard, what we can do. I told him I have a good experience in community organizing, but not in international organizing. So then we start discuss this, and Adnan took it forward, start discussing this with within the NGOs framework. I wasn't that much satisfied with the NGO's approach because NGOs is based on funding and agenda settings and so on. But in general, there were discussion. And then we decided to issue a call. This was at the beginning of the 2005. And this call started from the YMCA in Beit Sahour. It's next to Jerusalem, actually, not far away. If you know the area, it's in Bethlehem area. But basically, it's part of Jerusalem historically. And we just issued a call. Since that time till 2008 at the YMCA. Then I left because of my education. I left the United States. In the United States, I was a little bit fortunate to be exposed to different experiences, especially, and I would say it proudly, I was exposed to the Jewish activism in the United States. Because Jewish activism in the United States, you know, there is a good part of it that, because I took a course at Kennedy School with Marshall Ganz, and he was the guy who was organizing with the farmers during the late 60s, during the civil rights movement, and so on. So this was a good experience. But still, we did not develop a strategy. Until now, if you look at the BDS, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, it's a general framework. And it's decentralized movement. And this gives it strength and it also gives it some weaknesses. The strength is like every group can invent and develop their own strategy and tactics that suit their local environment. Their weaknesses, we do not have same discourse that bring us. I'll give you just one example. When you started this conversation, you highlighted this as part of the human rights issue. But other groups would frame this as decolonization and anti-settler colonialism. So from the beginning, there were discussion about this issue. And I took the side that we need to focus on framing this as part of decolonization in one side and of the social justice question and struggle around the world. Because if we do it in this way, we are able to deconstruct the others' narratives related to subjugation and racism and imperialism and workers' rights. If we look at it from this way, then we are building a historic block, something that worldwide, and it's like there is a consistency in the developing discourse and narrative. People who discussed with me this, and basically Adnan, he said if we are doing it this way, then we could lack some support from liberal groups and from other groups that do not have certain commitments or have their own different discourse regarding to the issue. I'll give you just one example because I also discussed this with Professor Ilan Pape. And we wrote a short article about this, published at Mondwise. It's like the green movement. We are talking about the green movement, how we can relate our struggle to the green movement. Especially that a lot of Jews who like to support Israel, like, you know, they support the Keren Kayemet, the Jewish Fund for Israel, by donating them to plant some trees. So we wrote about this, like using the green issues to cover the Nakba, the Palestinian catastrophe. If you have been in Palestine, you will notice that a lot of forests established over Palestinian villages. There were 447 Palestinian villages and towns that were demolished and evacuated from Palestinian citizens. So most of these villages now covered by forests. So a lot of Jews, and I'm not talking about them as accusing them, but I would say that a lot of them do not know that they are donating to for not a good cause when they are trying just to make, quote-unquote, Israel green. So they are not making Israel green. They are making Israel covering the crime that took place in 1948 and later on in 1967. So we are talking about when we are addressing the Palestine question within this framework, so we are raising the question of educating others how to do things. Actually, I'm happy with the Swedish activists, what they did now. What's the name of the girl? She was in the flotilla. When she addressed this issue that you cannot be green and support the green economy, but at the same time being condoning what Israelis do. So that's why we need to develop a certain, first of all, narrative, consistent narrative, discourse, and a strategy. If we developed a narrative, then we can develop a strategy because they are interconnected with each other.
Thanks for sharing those reflections. You talked about a historical trajectory linking the first and second Intifada, and I think critically really rooted the sense of the boycott movement targeting the Israeli government as having a root directly in Palestine, understanding the collective actions in the First Intifada and, of course, in generations previously, but in a very organized and articulated way in the First Intifada as expressing opposition to buying Israeli goods. That sense of collective boycott has now traveled the world. It's internationalized. You have formations like the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, or the Palestinian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel. I think it could be helpful for people to understand those formations as related to the grassroots history that you're talking about that was led on the ground by Palestinians. Maybe not exactly with those names, but at a grassroots level, as part of an activity of collective resistance, as one tactic amongst many that was developed during the First Intifada, and that as being connected to a multi-generational strategy of fighting colonialism on the part of Palestinians. I think that's really important to mention, is that connection to articulating, as you talked about, the Palestinian struggle as not just simply about human rights, but also as part of a struggle for land and against colonization. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this point.
Yes, actually, always as a community organizer, as organizer in general, and any organizer around the world, the major things would be how to set the goal, how to maintain the momentum. Setting the goal sometimes is easy because the goal could be something that as a response for a certain things that happened. So it could be like achievable within certain framework. But sometimes, and in a matter of anti-colonial issues, it's like a long process and you need to keep a momentum. And it's not easy to have this momentum. If you look back over the last 22 months, it was up and down. So it wasn't, we were not able always to galvanize the movement to have this push to go forward. Also, I believe that this one of the most amazing movements in the last 30 years, at least 30 years, that we have this sustainable momentum for 22 months. I could say from the history that this only happened during the late 60s, beginning of 70s, during the students' movement in Europe, and during the Vietnam War in U.S. So just to have this issue. So it's not easy to make people connect for a long time to do this. Also, it's not just like you are not having fun. As an organizer, as an activist, as freedom fighter, I would say it at some point, you have other things to do. You need to live your life. You need to earn your income. So you are not part of the corporate world that provide you with funds. So I one time make this disconnection with some Jewish friends and acquaintance. And when they ask me, do you think that Israeli settlers has a grassroots movement? I said, yes. I said, how come? How those are people just organizing at the community level? I said, they are living as community. They use ideology to cement their ties, and they have achievable goals. It's like to have their own dream built on from the scratch on the ground, grabbing as much as possible of land and ethnically cleanse the others. And they organize and put the pressure. But would those people commit to what they are doing without resources like from United States, Canada, from Western Europe, like these donations? Because they spend a lot of money. Those people just leave their job and stay in these communities. And some of them spend many, many years. They do not sacrifice their lives. But when you are talking about noble causes, you are talking about people who are sacrificing their lives. Literally, they are sacrificing their lives. Independent of their background, like national background, whether they are Jews or whether they are Arabs, whether they are Europeans or Asians or Africans, you know. And if we look just as a reflection, you know, I graduated in the master's degree from a good or one of the excellent schools in the world. Like I studied at Kennedy School, at Brandeis, at MIT. Then I found myself for 5 years was not able to get a job. And I wrote about this issue and was thinking that there are group of people who work, collect data about people and have a database, so they would not allow you to, when you apply to have a job, to get your job. Then we later find, lately, over the last few years, that we have the Canary Project. And this Canary Project started in U.S. and Canada. So they already traced us when we were in the United States universities. And they would, like, spot those who are activists. And because we just were just few number of people, they can track us and do all of these issues. But now we are a movement. It's not, we are not anymore just individual activists, especially when you are talking about North America. So this part of the issues, so this part of the reflection, now we are a movement. Because we are a movement, now we need a strategy. We need this decisive strategy. And what we mean by strategy, it is like strategic goal to look at the supply chain that sustain Israel to be strong, to continue doing what they are doing.
Thanks for sharing that. In the current context, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about what's currently happening on the ground in Gaza. It's been a really intense moment where the stories and images and video of what's taking place on the ground in Gaza has been communicated and shared through social media. People really articulated and talked about Palestinians live streaming their own genocide as part of this effort to try to mobilize people internationally to say no and to stand up. I wanted to ask about this in relation to that really important part of the story that maybe does not come through as clearly in social media because of the nature of that commodified platform. Just in the sense that a lot of the folks from Gaza that are sharing stories are, of course, connected to a broader community. And I wanted to underline here that importance of things like collective kitchens or music schools or high school teachers sustaining classrooms, in displacement camps, water distribution, all these collective organizing efforts that really speak not just to individual narratives, but to the collective sustaining and resistance of Palestinians in Gaza. I would love to hear your reflections on understanding the importance of this layer of what's taking place on the ground in Gaza today. Thank you.
Yeah, what you ask about is a very important issue. I would reframe it, where is the Palestinian voice in the international organizing? This one issue and the other things, I want to highlight the activism in Palestine. First of all, what we see of activism, especially in Gaza, it's a civil-based organizing. It's not an NGO's work. And with the civil-based organizing, you see that people put their life online. They might be killed. They are doing whatever they can just to assist their own community. They are engaged as part of their own community. NGOs have very different approach, and we see that NGOs already have a lot of resources, but I would have two main experiences. Those who have, like WF, World Food Organization, WFO, and many other, including UNRWA, which is an international organization. Those people try to work within what the Israelis provided them, within what the Israelis need them to do. And we already know that there were many meetings between these international organizations, international NGOs, and the Israeli army, actually in the Layman prison, where many Palestinians were killed in that prison. And we highlighted this, and you can find this online. So when we ask the people around the world to listen to us, we need to ask to make them listen to the civil-based activities, to the community actions, the direct actions on the ground. And here, a lot of activities around the world, like either to work with international organizations or work with the Palestinian Authority. And Palestinian Authority, for many of the Palestinians, and the majority of the Palestinians, especially in Gaza, they are security collaborators, security contractors for the Israeli army, the Israeli apparatus, occupation apparatus. But if you look, for example, here like in London, whenever we have what we call it the national national demonstration, we always have the so-called Palestinian ambassador to represent the Palestinian voice. Not the Palestinian communities. The Palestinians who like represent have long history of activism to share their voices. So they still, people need, the majority of them look for selectively certain Palestinian voices that suit and keep them within the mainstream. And this is the issue. And here we can talk about four different Palestinian voices within Palestine. First of all, we are talking about the Gaza. and this framed by the political situation. Within Gaza, the situation is very difficult, and people who took the initiative tried to do whatever they can. Israelis do not allow them. You know, Israel tried to engineer the starvation, and from one hand, from the other hand, tried to muzzle and even kill the journalists, as what happened few hours ago when they assassinated six journalists, among them the Al Jazeera journalist Sharif. So it's like we need to give priority to Gaza. But the problem with Gaza is how to communicate with the people in Gaza. Do we communicate with the people who left Gaza? Here, we need also to raise questions. Some of those people who left Gaza have the privilege to leave Gaza. So this is one of the issues. That's why we need to give priorities for the people in Gaza. When we are talking about West Bank, we have also different political circumstances. And within West Bank, we have at least two different groups. The people who are affiliated with the Palestinian Authority and the people who are not affiliated with the Palestinian Authority. This one issue. The most of the people who are not affiliated with the Palestinian Authority, they are activists either in Area C, 60% of the West Bank, where Israel exercised full control of security control and civil control over the Palestinians. So those people take the risk, as we have seen in Masafer Yatta, for example, in the Jordan Valley, the Bedouins, those people. We need to get in touch with those people. And we see some international activism that helps those people, especially in Masafer Yatta. International Solidarity Movement doing a good job in this. In this regard. So, civil-based struggle based on democracy, human rights, but based on anti-colonial approach and based on not only civil rights and but also justice for all.
Thank you so much for the conversation today, Samer.
Thank you for having me and giving me opportunity to share my opinion.
That was a conversation with Samer Jaber, who is a PhD candidate in political economy at Royal Holloway University in London. Thank you to Samer for sharing your insights on this week's edition of the show. Free City Radio broadcasts weekly. I'm Stefan Christoph. Thanks for tuning in. You can hear us on Wednesdays at 11 a.m. on CKUT 90.3 FM. On Thursdays at 8 a.m. on CGLO, 1690 a.m., also in Montreal. On CKUW, 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, on Tuesdays at 8 a.m. and Fridays at 1:30 p.m. On CFRC, 101.9 FM in Kingston, on Wednesdays at 11:30 a.m. On CFUV, 101.9 FM in Victoria, on Saturdays at 7 a.m. On Met Radio, 1280 a.m. in Toronto, on Fridays at 5:30 a.m. On CKUW, 93.1 FM in Ottawa, on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. On CJSF, 90.1 FM in Vancouver, on Tuesdays at 4 p.m. And on CHMA, 106.9 FM in Sackville, New Brunswick, on Tuesdays at 10 a.m. You can find our archives at soundcloud.com/freecityradio. We're also podcast. Just look us up. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll speak to you next week.
Is Rabble Radio, recorded on Friday, May 1st, 2026. I'm your host, Breanne Doyle. Rabble.ca shares the news of the day through a progressive lens. If you're curious